what was the mood like, or how did this story get out, and when did people realize, people who were at the game realize what had happened? Because there's a great, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's great video of, I believe somebody from the PR, a PR person leaning into DeMarcus Cousins as he's talking to the media, whispering something in his ear. And apparently that was when Cousins found out he was traded. And you kind of see his reaction, which leads to this quote about, I love playing in New Orleans. I love being in New Orleans, from DeMarcus Cousins. What was the mood like? When did you guys find out?
No, I wasn't in that scrum. So, you know, okay. You're kind of running around. You're trying to find your own, you know, you're trying to find
your own guys.
Where Kyle Lowry is and right. DeMar DeRozan is, and maybe get a Kevin Durant quote and a Russell Westbrook quote. So, you know, at that moment, you know, it was all kind of, no one really knew what was unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we finished taping our hit for Sportsnet, and I was sort of in the back room kind of writing, and next thing you know, the trade goes, and we had to go and redo everything. So, I mean, I just found out via social media roughly around the time, same time everyone else did. And, you know, and it was just one of kind of those weird nights.
What do you make of that deal?
There's a lot to make of it. You know, you're kind of processing it because there's a lot of elements that are a little bit difficult to explain. I think on the surface, if you go by the adage, whoever gets the best player wins the trade, then it's really hard to argue that New Orleans didn't do wonderfully, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, you can't really argue that DeMarcus Cousins isn't one of the most talented and impactful players in the game. And, you know, but when you kind of look at all the layers of it, you know, the DeMarcus Cousins is a guy with a lot of warts.
Mm-hmm.
And it really fundamentally comes down to the way, I mean, right now, I think he's got 16 or 17 technical fouls. He's already been suspended once. So, like, in the next, so every time he gets another T, he's looking at getting another suspension. And this has happened now for multiple years in a row. He's had very little success winning in Sacramento. And the real question, I think, going forward is that we're all waiting for the answer to is, was his environment in Sacramento, how much did it contribute to him kind of putting up red flag after red flag after red flag in terms of bringing a guy in, you're going to have to pay $200 million and what he's going to do to the culture around your team. And if he gets to New Orleans and meshes well with Anthony Davis and they can add a little bit of talent around them, and particularly, I guess they're going to need some shooting, and they have some success and all these kind of issues that have swirled around DeMarcus Cousins kind of fade away, then we'll have the answer.
Mm-hmm.
That really this is just a guy who, you know, losing is toxic. He was in a losing environment, in a kind of dysfunctional environment in Sacramento, and once you cleared away all the noise, he was just a really competitive guy and who needed a bit of structure. He goes to New Orleans and he ends up, you know, not meshing with Anthony Davis, and they continue to struggle. Well, you know, then it looked like Sacramento did the best they could.
Do you think that Masai Ujiri was involved in discussions on DeMarcus Cousins in any level?
I know that there were inquiries. I think it's definitely something that they've kind of tossed around over months. I'm not saying necessarily in the last couple of days.
Right.
And I know, and then even going back to last season, I think the issue has always been, you know, beyond whether they necessarily could make the deal or not, was there were serious concerns about DeMarcus Cousins and his character and his behavior and kind of bringing him into a situation here in Toronto where they've really nurtured culture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so do I know if they were in on making an offer? I don't think they were because it sounds like Sacramento didn't exactly, you know, go to the rest of the league and try and create an auction. And I guess you wonder, you know, the price you pay for something always kind of dictates how much risk you're going to take on. And And right. You kind of wonder if what seems like a pretty low price for a player that amount of talent, you wonder if that might change their appetite. I'm talking about the Raptors' appetite for risk, but I'm sure a lot of teams are wondering that today. I will say, though, I've consistently heard throughout the league that a lot of front offices, and it would seem to be explained by what New Orleans had to pay to get Cousins, a lot of front offices were legitimately concerned about DeMarcus Cousins as a person. Like I say, we're going to find out how legitimate those concerns were in the next months and years.
What did New Orleans give up?
Not much. Nothing, mm-hmm. really. Okay. I mean, they give up their own pick, which I think will be a mid-first-round pick. I think what Sacramento does get, there's a lot of ramifications to this deal. What Sacramento does get is the ability to keep they get New Orleans' pick, which is going to be in the middle mm-hmm. of the first. Just as significant, they get to keep their own pick. This is presuming that they slide down the standings and they don't have to surrender a pick they owed to Chicago, which they would have owed if they finished outside the top 10. So you presume that they're going to bottom out the rest of this year and they'll be outside the top 10. So they'll have a lottery pick and a mid-first round pick in what's supposed to be a very, very good 2017 draft. But one of the interesting details of this trade, it's probably a little complicated to get into on the radio, is if you recall the deal that Philadelphia pulled with Sacramento to get Nick Stauskas, mm-hmm. one of the sort of stray threads from that deal that's still out there is an unprotected 2019 first round pick. And the way it's projecting now, with Sacramento kind of headed for a fairly extensive rebuild, Philadelphia could be sitting on, like a top three, top five lottery pick.
Wow.
two seasons from now. And then just another recent conference team, along with the Boston Celtics, that has a pretty deep treasure trove of assets building.
You mentioned the Celtics. There was a lot of talk, at least from what we saw on social media and on the internet as well, about the Boston Celtics and Jimmy Butler, which has kind of gone on for a while. Mike, as I look at the East, it almost seems as if, and I'm not a fan of you make a move because somebody else made a move, but if I'm the Boston Celtics, it almost appears as if you're looking at this saying, we got to get something here.
Yeah, I think there's got to be some smoke there. You don't go out and spend $100 million on 31-year-old Al Horford mm-hmm. in the offseason and then kind of expect to use these two, this pick, which is supposed to be the number one, will likely be the number one overall pick that they're getting from Brooklyn in this summer's draft. It would seem to me, if you can find a good enough player, that you would surrender that pick because you're trying to win sooner than later, given that you've just invested so heavily in Al Horford. The only player out there that's been attached to Celtics that you would even consider surrendering a first, what would likely be a top three or top five pick would be Jimmy Butler and the Bulls.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got to be the move if the Celtics are going to make one. That makes a little bit of sense from my point of view, because otherwise, it's almost like their assets, those Brooklyn picks, are too valuable to use on anything other than an existing all-star, an impactful player that fits into your culture fairly seamlessly. And Jimmy Butler, you look at the Celtics lineup and a scoring two-way wing like Jimmy Butler would look pretty good. And obviously, from the Raptors' point of view, that's got to make you a little bit nervous.
Well, and I was going to say, there is a value in having these draft picks, but I mean, we've kind of seen with the Raptors as well, you don't want to find yourself in a position where you've got five or six first or second year guys. Now you're trying to find playing time for them while you're also trying to win a championship or, go as far as you can in the playoffs. Like, there has to be a balance there someplace, between just hoarding draft picks and using the players you have.
Yeah, and Danny Ainge is shown over the years, like with great success when he, you know, built the big three and won in 2008. That was sort of his strategy then, was he, you know, he hoarded assets, players, young players, draft picks, and, you know, he's able to translate those into Ray Allen and Kevin Garnett. So, you know, it's a proven strategy he's used. The only thing I'd say, though, Jeff, is what is likely projected to be the number one overall pick.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, that's a little different.
Okay.
You know, like the value of picks really, you know, any first round pick is valuable. Lottery picks are valuable. But obviously a pick that will at worst be, I think, the number three pick, depending on how the lottery balls fall, but could very well be the number one pick. You don't trade that unless you really, really know what you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because that player, a number, you know, as we, I'm not breaking any news here, the number one overall pick in the NBA draft usually ends up being a pretty impactful player on their own right. So,
right.
So the Jimmy Butler one is the one that makes sense. But after that, it's almost like, you know, there's not really any players in play that are good enough that you would want to use a pick like that on.
All right, let's shift focus a little bit to the All-Star game itself. Saturday night, I mean, that was, yeah, and I admit, Michael, my memories refresh of last year's All-Star game and Zach LaVine and Aaron Gordon. But, man, that was flat Saturday night. I mean, I don't know what it was like there, but on TV, it was almost painful.
Yeah, the whole weekend was. I mean, you know, not to sound like too much of a homer, but I think, you know, obviously you can't control the outcome of these events. But in Toronto, through luck or circumstance, the energy in the crowd, who knows? All-Star Saturday night was great. It was really, really good. The three-point contest, you had the two best shooters on the planet, arguably,
mm-hmm.
Klay Thompson and Steph Curry, who were teammates, kind of going down in the final. That was fun. And Klay Thompson put on an incredible display in the dunk contest we all know about. Even the skills competition was fun.
Yes.
With, you know, Karl Anthony Towns kind of making noise for big men. And on Saturday, it just didn't work out that way. You know, the three-point contest was a dud. The dunk contest was pretty much a dud, And so what you saw on the TV wasn't any different than what we saw in the building. And the game on Sunday was awful.
Yeah.
Like, it was terrible. And, you know, I think in the past, and, you know, I don't want to put my nostalgia glasses on because they're usually pretty foggy, but, you know, the All-Star, you kind of accepted that the All-Star game in basketball would be, it was a great spectacle, and it was great because the best players seemed to enjoy being in it, and for three quarters they sort of loped around, but the fourth quarter you saw something that looked like basketball, and once in a while you get a pretty good memory out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Last night's display and was none of those things. It was a complete, you know, it didn't resemble basketball at all. And I think Steve Kerr made some interesting comments after the game to the effect of, you know, this isn't football, right? Like, you can play a pretty competitive, pretty interesting and entertaining brand of basketball without risking life and limb. And, you know, and I think the NBA's got to find a bit of a balance going forward because, you know, they scored nearly, 378 points combined last mm-hmm. night, and that's with two teams shooting, I think, a combined 34-35% from three. So had they even shot the ball well, you would have had 210 to 205. And it's, you know, you got Steph Curry lying down on the floor to not get dunked on. And, you know, it's got to be better than that. And I think Steve Kerr's suggestion was, you know, what if you engaged, you know, players' charities, that the winning team would get some kind of cash reward they could donate to charity or something like that. Like, something that would at least incentivize players to take at least the fourth quarter of the game a little bit more seriously.
What about home court advantage? No.
I don't think that works out very well for baseball, but you know, it's on the players. You can't really legislate these things. But I think, you know, the pendulum swings, and right now it's far in on the side of, you know, we're barely even playing. And, you know, I don't really know a basketball fan that could watch that and go, wow, that was fun. You know, maybe a little kid because there's a lot of dunks and it was, you know, a lot of laughs and smiles. But I do think that there's a middle ground that could provide a little bit more entertaining spectacle.
Well, you know, we've always seen a lot of dunks and everything in the All-Star game, but it seems to me that what the past couple of years have missed is just a little bit of, you know, the contest, right? The contested play. I mean, I understand. Right. No one wants to get hurt. Believe me, I have no problem with that. But nobody contests anything.
Deny the ball.
Exactly.
Deny the ball. Make the ball handler have to turn twice. Do something. You know, I think Anthony Davis, he had 52, and I think 48 of his points came on dunk.
Yeah.
Like, you know, come on. The most interesting thing I did All-Star Weekend is I went to Basketball Without Borders on Sunday morning, kind of out in the sticks in Louisiana, where it's actually the New Orleans Pelicans practice.
It's lovely Matari, isn't it?
Matari, right. So yes. It's an All-Star game for Basketball Without Borders campers. And I went because there were 7 Canadian boys, 3 Canadian girls there. And that's really the only meaningful event at All-Star Weekend. There are a lot of team executives and scouts. It's an opportunity for them to see high school age kids. You know, they're not normally allowed to watch those kids.
Mm-hmm.
And you see them all in one place. They're from, and you're, you know, I'm watching scrimmages with teams. Literally, there'd be 10 kids on the floor from like eight different countries. You know, China, Japan, South Korea, Australia, Finland, you know, various African countries. And the Canadian kids that were there were outstanding. All 3 girls invited to the camp were named All-Stars. Rowan Barrett Jr., who, you know, is going to be one of these names we're all going to be hearing about a lot more. He was named the boys' MVP. He is a kid from Montreal, Lugens Dort, who mm-hmm. I was not familiar with before. He was an All-Star. Several other Canadian kids could have been All-Stars. So, you know, that was my most rewarding experience at All-Star Weekend.
Yeah, and I'm just reading your article on it. And, of course, Jamal Murray was the MVP of the Rising Stars Challenge.
Which actually, that game was a little bit better than the All-Star game.
Oh, I thought it was the same thing here in Toronto. I thought it was competitive.
Yeah, the young guys, you know, they have a little bit more skin in the game. Maybe they're trying to show themselves a bit more. And I think that game could go back to a rookie-sophomore format.
Yep.
And because I think there was a little bit more pride on the line there. But yeah, Jamal Murray was, you know, he stole the show Friday night. And he was at the Basketball Without Borders on Saturday, kind of visiting with the Canadian kids that were there. And, you know, so it's pretty fascinating where all this is going.
Now, you talked about Rowan Barrett Jr. He's in grade 10 at Montverde Academy, which is near Orlando. And as you point out, at the moment, he's expected to graduate in 2019, make some draft eligible in 2020. But I wanted to use that as a segue into something Adam Silver was asked at the State of the League news conference. What are you expecting to see from the NBA in terms of the minimum age? Because we've heard for a while now the talk about possibly lifting the minimum age or raising the minimum age. It wasn't part of the new CBA, Mike, I don't think. Negotiated in. I suppose both sides could agree to open the contract and negotiate it in. But where do you see that going, and how much of an issue is that for the NBA?
Well, it's one of those ones where it gets talked about a lot, and, you know, I'm not sure how big an issue it is, to be honest, because, you know, on paper, the union would advocate for, 18 and over being in the league.
Mm-hmm.
But behind the scenes, forever, there's only 450 jobs in the NBA, and for every 18-year-old who gets one right out of high school, that's, you know, a 9-year vet who doesn't have a spot. So I don't think there's a huge kind of advocacy within the players' union to pursue that goal. On the owner's side, you know, the older they can draft a player, with the exception of those superstars,
mm-hmm.
right? Like,
mm-hmm.
you want LeBron James in the league, absolutely, as soon as you possibly can get him, if you have a chance to draft him. But for almost everybody else, you know, you're happy to get them at 20, 21, 22 because they're a more finished product. You have to invest a little less in development, and you're paying them for the most prime years of their careers. Like Bruno Caboclo, like he may end up being an effective NBA player at some point in his career, but you know the Raptors will have sunk 4 or 5 years of money into him with no return at that point. So so that's kind of the gap in interest. And I'm not really sure how fervored I think the owners would definitely like players in the league a little later if they could somehow kind of weasel in some little exception for like the really, really good players that they all wanted sooner.
Right.
And I think from the union's point of view, they aren't really that motivated to have 18-year-olds in the league, but to the extent they can use that as a point of leverage with the owners, they will. So, I wouldn't be surprised if this is one of those issues that never really gets resolved, because I don't think there's a ton of momentum behind it to really push it. You know, that's sort of my take, but I'm not sure if that's actually the right one.